before playing this cool CD part, I'm going to play two fun facts about Marina. First fun fact, she speaks Dutch. And the second fun fact, before she started her career as a physicist, she was a professional dancer. So she started her physics career with a PhD at the University of Sussex under the supervision of Professor Andrew Lindell. And then afterwards she did a postdoc at Berkeley. And then ever since she's been sort of rotating between the University of Lisbon, Edinburgh, and PI, where she's currently an emulator fellow. Floor is all yours.
Thank you. Thanks for that nice introduction. So this is the topic. This works. Yeah. The first thing, thank you for the organizers for giving me the opportunity to give this talk. This is an ambitious title. I guess you can say that. And it actually, I wanted to embed it in the scope of the conference. I cannot have the time to explain why right now, but this is actually a project that starts with taking a brand new point to a starting point for quantum gravity. So you can ask me later, but if I say what that start point is, we are not going to make it past this slide. So first thing is this group of awesome people that I am so privileged to work with. They are fearless, in my perspective, in the sense that they don't fear any questions. And they don't fear the answers as well. And so this gives you a very good, you know, trampoline for working and asking questions and not be afraid to cross boundaries. The other thing I wanted to say is that this is work in progress, like really work in progress. Some of the results here are a few days old. And so there's going to be, lots of details. I have no clue what they are, and lots of results that I am not sure how to follow. And then, yes, I try to make it accessible, but ask questions. This is already set. So because everything here was going to be in proposed work or ongoing work, I thought of having one slide of Lee and I's work. So this is the seminal paper that Lee largely presented on Monday. There's a spin foam correspondence. There's extensions of GR. This is actually a little bit to do today. And I wanted to highlight this one, which is two papers that I'm quite proud of. Because what we did here, so underlying Lee and I's work is the notion of causality, fundamental causality and irreversibility. And so a few years ago, Yakir Aronoff was visiting here, and his group has a proposal for the violation of causality in quantum mechanics. And Lee and I, you know, got talking to them and were open and went, okay, let's see, let's work together and let's see if really you can prove that causality is violated in quantum mechanics. So we were not convinced. But anyway, it was really a substantial body of work, and that I enjoyed, you know, being open to possibly being proven wrong with our assumption of causality. So everything that I work on, or Lee and I work on, but mainly I'm driven by the search for irreversibility. I'm obsessed with irreversibility. What is the origin? What are the processes that cause it? Can we trace it all the way back to the Big Bang? Or does it happen at each point in time in a continuous irreversible dynamics? So, and it's the kind of thing that if I find what is the origin of irreversibility, I can then retire. I will die a happy woman, because
irreversibly.
Yes, good point, exactly. So the work with Lee started when I came back to PI in 2012. Lee had just finished his book, Time Reborn, where he proposed that time is fundamental as opposed to emergent. And then I got here and then I told him, you know, if you want time to be a fundamental quantity, then you have to include the irreversibility of time in your fundamental variables. So that's irreversibility and how we proposed this, the first couple of papers. Here is just one, actually, that simulated the energetic causal sets, and Lee describes this. And there's one thing he didn't say because he's too modest. But so our seminal paper won the Buchalter Prize, the first Buchalter Prize, cosmology prize. And there's a funny story that both of us got this email saying, you won a prize. Here's, give me your bank account details. And I'll give you $10,000. So what? Delete. Lee didn't even, you know, he looked at, you won a prize? So after a few days, you know, I called him, you know, there's this weird thing. And so it was the first prize, which now PI has a reputation for winning. Okay, let's start the talk. I can read from here. So cosmology is closely tied with irreversibility because we are assigned with the problem of initial conditions. Explaining, I can already say that the set of initial conditions to our universe has measure zero in the space of all possible configurations. And so just how small is that measure zero is a job of cosmologists, and it has been changing in recent years and in the last decade particularly. So what is the technique for asking what is the price to be paid at the Big Bang for explaining our universe? We can understand our universe if we accept that the initial conditions really have very low probability in the early universe. And so the first part of the talk is going to be about what is low, how low is that? So what we do is, it's a standard procedure. You compute the entropy of the universe today. Then you invert the formula, get the number of degrees of freedom, and that is a proxy for configuration space or phase space of the universe today. Then we assume that this configuration space has stayed constant throughout the universe's evolution, and the physical laws have stayed constant. plus the laws are deterministic. With these assumptions, we can then ask the question, what is the price to pay at the Big Bang for our universe? What is the magnitude of the problem that cosmologists have to solve? So until the last few decades, this is the traditional way of computing the universe's entropy today. It's a hot plasma. There are 10 to the 80 baryons with 10 to the 8 degrees of freedom per baryon. So the this is the entropy of the current universe, and the total number of degrees of freedom is that this one. This is, I don't know, papers from 1980, 1990 still have this. And so if that was the total number of degrees of freedom today, the universe that we saw would be a cold plasma like that, and not like that, which is what we want. This is switching on gravity and the formation of structure can grow. So the previous slide only has thermal motion of baryons. That's not what the universe is today. We wouldn't be here if the universe was only this. So we need to switch on gravity. Nobody knows what is the number of degrees of freedom in gravity, the entropy in gravity, except for the one case. And so that's what we'll do here quickly. There's a simple calculation you can do using the Bekenstein-Hawking black hole entropy formula. You assign, say that all galaxies are like, have 10 to the 10 solar masses, and 10 to the 6, I think, solar masses are in the massive super black hole in the middle. So number of the baryons is this, entropy today is that one. Actually, I want to skip this for now. Actually, no, I want to say that. And so this is the entropy of today if the universe is made out of galaxies, and in the you just assume that most of the mass of the galaxy is in the black hole. So then we had this fantastic thing this year, and I computed how much would it be to have the how much more entropy would we have if every galaxy had an M87 black hole at the center instead of just our Sagittarius A. So it just goes from 10 to the 101 to 10 to the 104. Right, so are we done counting? Is that so? Then in that case, the price to pay at the Big Bang is explaining a likelihood which is 1 in e to the 10 to the 104. And here is Roger Penrose's famous picture where he's saying this is almost like the most exquisite fine-tuning, or, you know, some deity placing a pin in the configuration space to this accuracy. There's this number of states in the Big Bang, and we are in one. I don't think it's very easy for cosmologists to do this. So are we done counting now? Is that the entropy of the universe? No. There is a slight here, slight gentle curve upwards, outwards in the late universe. So we have not counted that. And that is the vacuum. Dark energy here are was our second Nobel Prize in cosmology, the big thing. here's Darkenergy. Of course, you know, everybody knows that Darkenergy dominates the energy budget today. And because of that, it also dominates the entropy budget today. And the formula is given by the Bekenstein bound. And so the price to pay is then 10 to the 120 is the value of the entropy, and this is the likelihood of the Big Bang. I don't know, you know, I've never seen a number this big. If you ever come across something like that, if you have to explain, you know, you need an exponential to represent the exponent. It's not going to be very easy.
Are you talking about the entropy of the cosmological
horizon? Yeah.
We're in a de Sitter universe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that seems to be accepted by. And actually, Ted Jacobson was going to give this talk before, and I thought he was going to make it easy for me by introducing everything. But you have a question?
That was the
question. Oh, okay. Okay, so are we done counting now? We have dark energy in the picture. And for these, here's where the project starts. What is your ambition for cosmology? If you're a cosmologist, what do you want to get out of it? What parts of the universe do you want to explain? What are the seeds that you want to understand at the Big Bang? So the conventional view is that the cosmos is a theoretical model where galaxies can be treated and modeled as points in a homogeneous isotropic fluid, and then you study and explain the origin of homogeneities. For me, and this is a personal view, but this is the cosmology that I would like to do, the cosmos is all there is, all there was, all there will be. I read this when I was very young. I was still dancing, like Beatrice said, and I've never forgotten it. I don't know if maybe it made my ambition for cosmology a little bit different, but the point is that my ambition for cosmology is that ultimately I will want it to explain everything we see. And so why I'm here right now as well, and I just started stamping my foot. So it's the personal view, so it doesn't mean that all cosmologists feel like this. It's my interpretation and my ambition. And so this is the project. There is one number that we have not included in our entropy budget. Our counting of the degrees of freedom so far looks like this. The universe is like this, and I will explain what I mean by that, and not like that. So the question is, what is the configuration space of the biosphere? What is the entropy of life? There's a reason why I'm asking this question, which to begin with, I don't know if I say it here already. No. So the question, what is the entropy of life? Is it sizable and to be accounted for at the Big Bang? Or is it negligible compared to lambda? I think we would all say it's negligible. But let's give life an equal status and democratically attribute biological systems with their own microphysical degrees of freedom, what number will we find? How does that number compare with the degrees of freedom of black holes? Is it ignorable, or will we find something new? And so this is, can we aspire to take the first small steps towards including biology in our discipline? So the first remark is that this is a little bit of a ridiculous statement, because there are less particles on Earth by I don't know how many orders of magnitude than in the universe. And so you can think of it like this. I can take every particle in a classical configuration system, a configuration space, give permutations of all the particles on the planet, the biosphere, say up to a 10-mile radius above sea level, and that's going to be a much smaller number than this one, than lambda. So the caveat is then, and this is what we get from our theoretical biologist friends, that the physical configuration space or phase space we use in physics does not account for the formation of complexity, of complex structures. So if you, there are new degrees of freedom that arise in the dynamics of complexity in general, so condensed matter, but particularly this is more powerful in biological systems that are not captured in our combination of permutations in position momentum of configuration space. And so this is what our friends, again, biologists are telling us, that, you know, this is, we in physics use the Newtonian paradigm, and they're right. So the configuration space is a 6n dimensional space with where n is the number of particles. And again, you have the deterministic laws, you get the initial conditions or boundary conditions, and then you can study, you assume laws for them, and you study the, your system. This view is clearly, has been in, prevailing in physics and fundamental physics even more recently for 200 to 300 years. And it's true for systems where the configuration space stays constant and the laws are deterministic. So in 2016, Lee and I organized a conference and on time and irreversibility. And one of the sessions was given by Stuart Kaufman, Barbara Drossel, and George Ellis. They had their own view of irreversibility, and they were proposing this weird concept, which is the when complex structures arise, that creates an arrow of the dynamics. And so they argue that the formation of structure and complexity follow a top-down causation. So that you cannot understand the whole by breaking in smaller constituents. So you cannot understand the whole by understanding the elements. And so they argue there are limitations of the Newtonian paradigm that you use in physics if you want to understand the emergence of complexity. And particularly Stu propose this, which he is quite famous for, the adjacent possible, which is to substitute the configuration space. And there are, so the argument is when you are in the biosphere and you are at a step in the evolution of the planet or the, a physical organ, a biological organism, you cannot pre-state what is the configuration space at that moment and at that position? Because the laws that underlie what emerges in on the planet in biological evolution, that you cannot know what is going to happen. And so what we would like to do is write down the configuration space for the starting of life 3.5 billion years ago. And from that, you know, use our computers and pop, here we are. So don't say these anywhere close to Stu, because you will get very upset. So he proposed the theory of the adjacent possible. I will try to explain a little bit what it is. And so it means that the configuration space in biology is always increasing. The universe is made this computation several times, is highly non-ergodic, which means that in order to fully explore the configuration space of this, of the biosphere, for example, you would need, if you went at a microsecond per state in speed of the cycle, you would need several Hubble times. So he said, why are you guys still having the configuration space if this makes no sense? I mean, truly, you just explore a trajectory in configuration space and you cannot pre-state what are the possibilities to come. So cannot be pre-specified, it is ever increasing, and the constituents in a given space and the given state, they form and create novel structures. So it's like a combinatorial process of, you know, the fish develops a swim bladder for the first time, and happens to be a bacteria swimming along who looks at that and, hey, that's a good place to go live in. I'm gonna go live in the swim bladder of this fish. And all of a sudden, the bacteria now is a lot more, has a lot more selective advantage. And there are just things that these kind of things, what is possible, cannot be written down before. So we cannot write laws in the differential form to predict what the next fittest organism will be. Nature will always surprise us. And this is, we cannot integrate the equations of motion to predict what a person will decide or what an organism will do. Yes?
I'm not sure this is the right place or time to ask the question, but the same is true for a box of gas, right? You cannot integrate the equations of motion.
For a box of gas?
Yeah, for the individual molecules. We know it's impossible in practice. It's completely impossible to integrate the equations of motion more than a microsecond. I don't know the exact time. But
that's very interesting.
A very short time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's really a qualitative difference between...
I think there's a qualitative... Yeah. There is, yeah. There is. I'll get to it. So biologists seem to be okay with this impossibility of pre-stating the future or predicting the future. And physicists were a bit more stubborn. So I've heard Stu shouting at me several times because I can't seem to understand, except that, you know, it cannot be derivable, but I want to derive it. No, but it can't be. No, I don't care, but I want to derive it. So, and last month, I don't know if anyone knows who John Brockman is, or has anyone heard of the EDGE Foundation, organization? No, okay. You should check it out. Oh, okay. So I was talking with John Brockman last month, and I proposed this, I talked about this topic, and he gave me his last EDGE essay collection, which is a book called What Are the Last Questions? It goes around, asks all these prominent people. Most of them have published books with Brockman Inc. And so he shows me this, you know, this, what you are asking is the same question. It appears three times in my last essay, a collection of replies. So the first one is from a Nobel Prize in physics. What is the master principle governing the growth and evolution of complex systems? Which is one of the questions. or is a way of phrasing what I'm asking. Seth Floyd, who you might know from quantum computing, how did our universe arise out of simple physical laws? Another physicist. And this one is, what is the principle that causes complex adaptive systems, so life, organisms, minds, societies, to spontaneously emerge from the interaction of simpler elements, chemicals, cells, neurons, individual humans? And so about a month ago, you might have been to Stuart's talk. And we spent that week, we spent, I don't know, every afternoon discussing for several hours whether there was really a principle that you could bring up. And that is the only thing that we could find. The name of the game is getting to exist. There's nothing else that you can make a rule for underlying biological evolution. So getting to exist is the closest you can find. And where I want to get right now is here. Stu gives a very good example, or you know, you can't put an upper bound on the number of uses of a screwdriver. Because if you list them all, I can always come and make, you know, oh, I'll take a screwdriver and smack you over the head. Or there's always, you know, we tried this game and he always can come up with something. And just as it cannot be predicted that a bacteria will all of a sudden jump on the back of another bacteria and find a selective advantage in that. It's like the possibilities cannot count. And we can't, and this is something that was in Raphael's talk, that when somebody asks, what is not an event? Is that right? Did they ask that? Do you remember? No.
There was something
the
about
answer to that was very simple.
A possible event.
Just a non-measurable set, that's it.
Okay.
I think that
so,
can answer that question.
Okay, good. So I thought, well, there is nothing that you can say, this is not a function or possibility for my system. And by induction, we show that that is divergent. So the number of possible states in the biosphere is not bounded, is unlimited. If it's unbounded, then in physics, we have experience in regulating infinities. And we can make an approximation that will bring the value down to finiteness. The question is then, is that number that we can compute, which is finite, is that larger or smaller than the entropy of the vacuum, which is this number? And so I am going to give one example. This is the project, computing a finite number for the number of states in the biosphere. I'm going to give one example of the number we got so far, which, so I'm going to talk about this. Mutual information, I don't want to talk about. If you want, ask me later. I think it's too much for today. But this is an equation that they developed in growth of biological systems. It's based on combinatorial innovation and can be applied to ideas in society, to the invention of patents, to human creativity, and also to living cells. It basically goes like this. This is the number of states at a given time. And then you want to know what is possible after these. You just make a sum of all possible permutations of subsets of that existing MT, and then you give it a weight to mean you want the likelihood to decay as your number of subsets becomes larger, because things cannot find each other. So this alpha reflects a decrease in finding and testing new combinations. But the interesting thing about this equation, and by the way, this is a simplistic that I didn't want to make very complicated here, is a deterministic version, and there's no extinction, which is not true in biology. But the interesting thing is that it has explosive growth, a rate of explosive rise in the number of states at a finite time. And so this is the plot that they make with certain parameters. And they do this. There's a phase where, you know, the number of diversity is very small, and then there's time to infinity, time which at which it suddenly explodes. And Stu made a very good, in this paper here, there's a very good analysis of human science in this case. So he starts by saying that from 15,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago, our tools almost didn't develop. We just had a rock cut with the faces, and the thing wasn't, they didn't find almost any evolution. All of the sudden, and then slowly it starts to increase, and then he makes this point. There's only 66 years between the first cross of the Atlantic by flight and the landing of a spacecraft on the moon, and we previously have been 5,000 years, 10,000 years waiting with no evolution. So human creativity and endeavor, clearly in recent decades and maybe a century, has reached explosive growth. So Lee made an early computation of this equation, and he found that even when you truncate the number of combinations to only two, so you only take combinations of two elements to make a complex element, that still blows up. So more or less, it's indicating that if you have enough stuff, you're going to get to this infinity region. So this is my last slide before the conclusions. This is a computation that Stu made and got us to this number. There are 10 to the 5 variables in an organism at any one time, 100 billion species, and correlations between them to 3.7. There's around 100,000 organisms in a species, and he computed these by approximating the number of combinations, again, just to two. That's large, but it's not lambda. So we are in the process now of revising this. And I pointed out, you know, humans have a trillion cells. And even if we just had give each cell an on-off switch, which biologists, I guess, would become radically very angry that we are treating the cell so simplistic, that would be a better computation of this number than just having these variables at a time per organism. Oh, check time, yeah. So, so I'm going to skip these because there's the conclusions. I skipped that part. It's about mutual information and how, let me see how to put this, how in most of physics, classical physics, we can skip the notion of absolute, of mutual information, so information within a context, but in quantum mechanics we can't. And so the notion of mutual information that was here is actually a very good one to measure the correlated information within biology. So conclusions. These are the first steps, I hope, into bringing the biosphere into cosmology. The first computation of degrees of freedom from a physical point of view, from physicists. I hope, if we are successful, that we would aim to start a new field. And in a way, this is what I'm going to say next, this creates, gives us an assessment of where exactly we are placed in the information content of the universe and of all our living beings on the planet and of the biosphere. How much is it worth in information cost? Finally, I will reveal why we are excited about this. I mean, it's exciting, but there's even more ambition further, which is to use this result for climate change. So the arguments for climate change are normally done by climatologists. They have seen their reputation systematically undermined by vested interests, big oil. And in, when you are arguing to defend the biosphere, it's you're talking with biologists, and they, you know, why should I defend the biosphere? They give you a paragraph of words. It's because it's unique, it's rich, there's nothing like it on the universe, it's very special, and so we need to preserve it. Some minds, like us, are more, tend to be more receptive to quantitative statements. And so the ambition is that if we produce a number computed by non-climatologists, by physicists, that expresses and quantifies the uniqueness of our biosphere, there's possible that it might convey to a larger number of minds how special, it's like a hard number that you can show how special our planet is. And we cosmologists are still listened to. No, big oil does not come to us and say, hey, you know nothing about what you're doing. So maybe this is our far-fetched ambition. And so the goal would be to hit the headlines with something like that. Cosmologists find that there's more information in life than in the remainder of the universe. So let me see.
Do you mean that the entropy is all on our biosphere? Saying the opposite.
No. I'm not talking about entropy because entropy in biology is tricky. I'm talking about degrees of freedom.
The information, okay. You're saying there's more.
Yeah, I mean, this is what we thought was going to be a headline for a newspaper. So, you know, you can't put degrees of freedom on the headline. But yeah, there's the sense is to convey that you know, to the, that there are more degrees of freedom in biology.
So would this assume then that in our biosphere is the only one in the entire universe?
That's a good question, yeah.
Given the size, we'd have, you know, possibility of many, and then of course ours cannot represent the entire biodiversity of the
Yeah, that's a good
universe.
Question. So we can use, there's 10 to the 22 solar systems. And if we're desperate, we can, you know, go there and put it into the exponent. The thing is that you then lose the specialness. You're not going to convince anyone by saying, hey, ours is one of 10 to the 22 life. So if I can, I will not resort to that. And I think we can. But if there is or if there aren't, yeah, for sure. I think there is more life on the universe. So this is a, let me just do this. This is my crew, and I want to thank them because they were being really very nice yesterday and today when I was writing this talk and I was a bit paranoid. And this is a conference for women, or about women. So that's the end.
Any questions from Marina?
You had this equation, I guess it was the one that you derived from, like the one for the
yes.
adjacent possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me like, okay, it's very simplistic in some sense, but like has he considered like some kind of feedback mechanism from the
yeah.
environment where like, you know, the structure of the environment and like the complexity is not really in that equation. So like the complexity that arises should somehow modulate those alpha in some way.
Yes, yeah. So that has been done. Like I said, that equation is deterministic. It doesn't have extinction of systems, of items in the present state. And it's not very simple because it's got a combinatorial factor. So if you start with only 200 states, the number of states that will give rise to and explode to is already several times the Hubble time to go through each state. So it's a very complex equation. It's difficult to compute. You need to make analytical approximations. But definitely, you're right that there are lots of more ingredients that you can put.
So like one thing that I'm thinking of that you could maybe try to explain with like a more sophisticated equation, like in the history of the biosphere, say, there were times where the kind of complexity of life kind of plateaued, and then due to some catastrophic events, when you kind of restrict the kind of number of life forms,
mm-hmm.
you suddenly see a like big expansion of in complexity.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you could somehow, maybe not with this equation, but with the similar equation, try to give some sort of explanation to this phenomenon.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
So I'm a little confused about the comparison of your definition of states in this biological setting to the definition of states that are used in...
What is my definition of states?
So, well, I'm not sure, but that's the question. I mean, when this bacterium swims into a fish's air bladder,
yeah.
is that not describable as a set of locations and momenta of the atoms that make
it's describable, but it's not predictable.
I'm not asking predictable, but
oh, yeah.
I'm saying, doesn't that then make it a set of a subset of the possible states of all of the positions of those atoms
of that current?
Yeah.
Moment. It does not make it a subset of the configuration space of the vacuum entropy at the Big Bang.
Why not?
Because a configuration space of position momentum in physics, a 6n, a 6-dimensional times n, a configuration space cannot capture, will not give you the arising of complexity in life.
But at that moment, it's a subset of the six.
Yeah, but remember that in cosmology, the trick so that you can ask the question at the Big Bang is to assume that the configuration space and the physical laws have been constant and deterministic all the way back to the Big Bang. So you can't, under our Newtonian paradigm in physics, we can't then come and say, oh, actually, no, here's a couple more states that I need to include right now because I want to capture these bacteria. So the Newtonian paradigm of configuration space does not have the ability to predict the formation of structure. And this is true even I skipped that slide because I wanted to wrap it up, but it's true even of condensed matter research. And I can explain to you what Nobel Prizes in condensed matter have been arguing about fundamental physics and that, well, basically they say that that's it. There's a phenomena in condensed matter that cannot be reduced and understood in terms of simpler phenomena. And so they say that research of those phenomena should be as fundamental as research in particle physics or cosmology.
Sure. I mean, that's like an effective theory, right? I mean, fundamental degrees of freedom are the same number of atoms and molecules, same number of atoms, same number of particles in the universe. So that's the full degrees of freedom. Effective degrees behave differently. We know this in condensed matter all the time. So,
yeah.
I mean, you need new physics at different scales, and that's something we understand as the paradigm that makes sense. And even things like living systems, right? I mean, you know that you can active matter, people have done amazing, taken amazing leaps in understanding how active matter, you know, behaves. So people doing theoretical physics with such in such systems. So I think it just seems to me that it's not a question of degrees of freedom or information as much as finding the right effective degrees of freedom that will describe your system. And that's what physics...
Okay, that's fine. But I've explained the setting very well.
Okay.
That for cosmology, in order to ask the question, what are the initial conditions? You need those assumptions. If you don't have any assumptions and you know the entropy of the universe today, you cannot ask the question of initial conditions. If you don't know, if you cannot assume that the fundamental laws are unchanged since the Big Bang. So that's how it works in cosmology. Yes.
Good.
Oh, Raphael has one.
Bianca, I want me to end the discussion. Sorry, you get to talk to Irina afterwards. Luckily,
yeah. Okay, we'll do some end. You can stay around as long as you want. So that's Irina.
And let's take.